We had a whole discussion with Rabbi Grunblatt on the messaging of Chofetz Chaim in general, and is the yeshiva, you know, off its message, because people are thinking the yeshiva is one way, not the other way. It's so interesting. He said over something that Rabbi Lubin said a couple of years ago, which was unusual. Mamash same avart. He said in the army, when they need you to volunteer, so they ask for volunteers, and from the volunteer asking volunteers, what usually happens? Anyone that wants to volunteer, please step forward. So what happens when that's announced? Most of the enlisted men take a step backwards, and the two shlamazels who didn't take a step backwards fast enough end up are the ones who volunteered, because if you're last, then you volunteered. That's basically the way it works. They didn't really volunteer, but they didn't not volunteer. So then they like volunteered. So basically what happened in the yeshiva world, post-World War II, that beforehand in Europe, all the yeshivas had very strong shittas on a lot of areas, which I heard Rabbi Lubin said the exact same message. Just he did it in an hour, and Rabbi Lubin said it in a minute. Which was probably Kedakta Bakardish. I mean, that's Shmuzima, very, very short. They're like 8 minutes long sometimes. And why don't we get the point out first. Basically, Tells had Shittas of Tells, and Kamenetz had their Shittas, and Slabodka had their Shittas, and, you know, Volozhin. There are a lot of different in Lublin, and a lot of different shittas of yeshivas, and everyone had their shittas, and there was always mechabta shel Torah and fighting with each other, and who's the, you know, which derech is the amita shel emes. It was understood that there were different shittas. The altar was by Slabodka, and, you know, Baruch Ber, and Rabbi Lubin brought as a raya one Adam Gadol, which he did not name, but. We said this over once.
That's imprint.
Yeah, that he said that he knows he's going to go to Om Haba because at least he fought against the Musar movement. Can you imagine nowadays someone saying they fought against the Musar movement? Like, that, you know, but that's what he held. That's so strong that he's going to go to Om Haba because he fought against it, that rishus of the Musar movement. So there was very strong opinions. Basically what happened post-World War II is that most of the yeshivas just took a step back and they stopped fighting and they just accepted everyone. Like they had a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of that. It became one big chulam. They weren't fighting anymore. They basically have a tzur of a yeshiva, but the rebbeim could be from different yeshivas. You can have a telzer for a 9th grade rebbe and a brisker for a 10th grade rebbe and a lakewood for an 11th grade rebbe. And it's one big, you know, I had in my Kamenetz, I had a 9th grade Rebbe was from Staten Island, and the 10th grade was from Rav Poller, and the 11th grade was from Lakewood, and 12th grade was from Lakewood. Okay. So that was all these different shittas, but so everyone took a step back, and Chofetz Chaim was the only yeshiva that basically kept their shittas. So if this would have been Europe, people would have hacked us tremendously, but they wouldn't have been such a big thing because the other yeshivas also had strong shittas. But now it's almost like we're the only ones with shittas, you know. And
what happened then?
Huh?
What happened that made everyone just?
Because the yeshivas lost their leaders. The yeshivas basically, you know, everyone threw in, ended up in Vilna. They lost their identity to a large extent. Now it's only supposing. This is not my expertise, but one conjecture is that they lost their identity. Everyone came to Vilna and they were decimated, and the Mir yeshiva stayed intact. Because the Mir yeshiva went to the Mir, and Slabodka, for the most part, went to Hebron before World War II, and they stayed intact to a certain when they were in Shanghai, and when they were in Eretz Yisrael, she would stay intact, but it lost it after the altar, and it also lost. But and that was the godless Luben brought out the Rav David Leibowitz, that he tried to replicate Slabodka exactly as is. That was what was unusual, exactly as is. And the American yeshivas, you know, Tells to a certain extent did keep there, but they, you know, Tells in Cleveland, you know, did try and keep some semblance of what Tells was. They said Tells, the hashpah of Tells was so strong that once you got to Cleveland, you already felt it. Some line like that. The Tells did keep it for a while, but you know, Tells, you could always tell what Tells are. A Tells are, you know, had. Payas.
Yeah, absolutely not.
They had long trim beards, and they smoked. Telzers all smoked. There was like certain schnitt of a Telzer, but that also over time we lost that also. Cleveland, yeah, basically.
What happened? Is it that their band themselves became Chillin' because they had a different bame, or
no?
Is it
because they had no feeder. They had no feeder. And the other yeshivas opened up, and they lost their feeder. People stopped going, so really they had no talmidim. And also, another thing, Rav Gifter, you know, was quoted as saying that, you know, he said a lot of shir, but he didn't have talmidim like the yeshiva did. He envied the Rashiva, that the Rashiva had Talmidim. So to have Talmidim, you have to have a Derech, you have to have a, you know, but a gift, of course, had a Derech and Tells, but the Talmidim had, you know, he didn't have his father's Sora. Okay. The second round. Yeah, yeah. So on that topic of, you know, where Mesorah is, we were discussing Rabbi Gumblat, maybe the yeshiva should, you know, be able to become mellow about, you know, certain things. Maybe we should encourage more, you know, white shirts, or maybe that. But Rabbi Gumblat did not think that it was going to make much of a difference, because there are so many other things that we're not going to be able to tinker with, like in the many of the Shiva world. They're, I don't know how to put it. They're much more allergic to American culture than your average Chofetz Chaim guy. They're just like allergic. So, one of the Charlies, I went to one of the sessions of the. You know, I didn't know anyone in the room. So if I didn't know anyone in the room, I was asking questions to one of the yeshivas who shall remain unnamed. Not that he said anything wrong, but you're going to take it as Lashon Hara if I say who it was, because he was answering a different type of group. He must have known who he was answering. To me, I was like in shock. But one of the questions that was asked is like, what do you do if a Rebbe in the yeshiva spoke Sichas Chulin in the Beis Medrash? That's like, another question of, they want to have a very clean apikadosh v'tar dormitory. What would be acceptable reading material for dormitory? So the Rashiva asked, like, what are you asking? Like, what are you asking? I should tell you, give you a list of books. Like, what are you asking? So he clarified and said, like Yeted and Hamodia, is it permissible to read in the dormitory? So I even think he was joking about that, but. But then the Rashiva said, Yated, I wouldn't recommend Yated.
What do you think he was going to wait on him?
Yeah, I wouldn't be. Yeah, I don't think he. Yeah, I thought maybe he's joking back on him, but no.
What?
It was serious. Just you have to dehair where you know, I'm again, this is recorded. I am not saying this to cast dispersions or to ridicule the Mahalach. That is totally, do not misunderstand me. I want to bring out that there is a segment of the Torah population that is, you know, espousing extremely extreme views that we would view it like, okay, I thought he was joking, and he wasn't joking. So okay, so what's gonna happen? So you're gonna tell the guys to wear white shirts. I think our Gemara, that's right. It's like it'll be Gunish Telfin. Can you imagine wearing a white shirt and reading Yated? That's like Tovel Besheretz Biyado. You have a white shirt with a Yated? You crazy? How could they coexist?
Show that we're changing, just the simon that we're changing is.
Why should we change?
Rabbi Grunblatt thought that this is a very important yisod to keep in mind. I'm glad that it's recorded just for this, not the intended topic for tonight, but one of the reasons why we try not to make too many changes is because the anticipated result is often not what you get. For example, I want to make a change. So what I'm going to do, I make a change in the school that I'm having a lot of students who are very upset that this school day is so long. So I'm going to make a change. Instead of getting out at 6:15 Mondays and Wednesdays, I'm going to say, you know what, we'll get out at 5:15 Mondays and Wednesdays, just so the kids won't be upset. Why don't we do that? Keep the Tuesday, Thursday mishmar, but twice a week, get out at 5:15 instead of 6:15. One hour, and solve all the problems. People won't be upset anymore. Okay, great idea. So, now, what's your anticipated result?
People are happier.
The guys will be happier and maybe attract more kids. Okay, what happens? People see the change in schedule and says, oh, the school is becoming like a day school. So now all the kids who were coming to real yeshiva now say, oh, the yeshiva turned into a day school. So we don't want to send the kids to a day school. We're going to send the kids to a real yeshiva. So you save the 10 kids from being, now they're happy, but now you lost 30 kids because they want to go to real yeshiva. So the anticipated result was you're going to be more attractive to kids in the community, and you're going to end up losing kids because now they think you're a day school. So that'd be one example. Rabbi Lubin once gave me the following example. He was trying to explain to somebody what we use Rabbi Foreman. People, we were getting attacked by people that, like, how can you hire Rabbi Foreman? He's not the Rosh Hashiva. And don't we ask our shalas to Rosh Hashivas? Rabbi Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Grunblatt, Rabbi Harris. Were you asking your shalas to Rabbi Foreman? So, or as Rabbi Lubin liked to say, Dr. Foreman? So, Rabbi Lubin, this is Rabbi Lubin's teretz. He said, no, we do not ask shalas of Das Torah to Rabbi Foreman. However, let's say I want to make a rule in yeshiva that I don't want to allow leather yarmulkes. You know, I don't even see them anymore. Kippah ors. You know those six? Anybody here have them? No.
Yep.
You have one. For Purim.
No, so,
you know those leather yarmulkes with the suede? So I want to make a rule. It's pasnish for yeshiva bacher to wear a leather yarmulke. The reshiva was against the leather yarmulkes, but not be'etzem, and then not in Miami either. I remember Yehuda used to wear a leather yarmulke. Yehuda Palgon used to wear the leather yarmulke. Not in Miami, because Miami, those nuances didn't make it to Miami. So you could have a very good kid wearing a leather yarmulke, doesn't even understand what it means. But in New York, it meant something. So he said, if I want to make a rule, no leather yarmulkes, because I want to modern, it stands for modern Orthodox, and I want to teach the kids that we don't stand, we don't agree with modern Orthodoxy. So I would, before I implemented that rule, I would speak to Rabbi Foreman first. And I would tell her, what I want to do is I want to make a statement and teach my Talmidim that we don't support modern Orthodoxy. I'm not saying that's the rule of the yeshiva or the theory of the yeshiva, but let's say we wanted to come out and say we don't agree with modern, and therefore, and to do that, I want to get rid of an aser wearing leather yarmulkes, because I would ask Rabbi Foreman first if we should do it, because what he might say is, oh, you think you're going to eradicate modern Orthodoxy? It's going to make it worse. You're going to bring on more people to modern Orthodoxy, because what's going to happen is, and he was very good at being Rolos and Nolot. So that's why often the anticipated result, why we don't make changes so fast, like you're asking about, wouldn't, Matan was asking. But if we just tell the people, the guys in Shiva, to only wear white shirts, won't it show people that it's gonna, that we're more? No, it may make it worse. You know, people say, oh, you know, look who's wearing white shirts. Like, it may be worse. I don't know. That's why we. I'm not saying it will make it worse. I'm just saying that's why we like to not make so many changes, because you can't anticipate. You think you're making something better, but you're gonna end up making it worse.
Isn't there also, I was asking, of change also, Masora, like all of a sudden we're going to change now?
We do change Masoras. You know, Masoras do change. I have a raya, because it's in a lot of the Gemaras, you see what they used to wear. They used to wear suits. They had, you know, these cloaks. You know, nobody wears cloaks anymore. Men don't wear dresses. But in the old days, that's what they used to wear. So at what point did the yeshiva guys stop wearing cloaks and stop wearing pants and a jacket? Things change, you know, people change, you know, clothing changes. There are a lot of things that do change, Masora, but as Rabbi Grunblatt said on Shabbos, like, we're just very hesitant to make change. We do believe some things have to change, but we're very hesitant to change. Look, Rabbi Grunblatt Harris, I remember being at Balachar in Yeshiva, and there was Seder on Isru Chag Sukkis, Isru Chag Pesach. Seder. You expected to be in Yeshiva the morning after Motzoi Sukkis and the morning after Motzoi Pesach. There was Seder. No, you'd have to do that for Shacharis and Mishmur Seder. And I used to go. I remember I used to go. And Rabbi Lubin, who I did not share, seeing the kol had off for that Isru Chag. When I got married, I'm off Isru Chag. Wow. I could help put away the Pesach dishes and take down the sukkah. You know, but that was a very big thing. So they changed that. They don't do that anymore. That's Ray Harris. I think that was one of his first edicts, is he got rid of those. That was crazy. It was mamish crazy. I remember being here in Miami. I'm saying this on tape. I'm saying it. So I remember I was branching in Miami, and there were six guys. Myself, Rabbi Sharfman, Zatzal, Rabbi Wiener, Rabbi Muscat, Rabbi Yachnis, Rabbi and Zemworth. We're branching. Yeah. No, his brother, his younger brother. And we were branching in Miami, and Rabbi Grunblatt, they paid for our tickets. We were branching for 6 months. You know, that was he got a whole couple. He moved here that first year. And he needed guys to come with him, older guys. We were all finished shiurim, so we weren't even in shiur. We were working on our own chaburas. And it was wonderful learning. But it was Sukkot time, and they had to fly us back. So he said he found $69 tickets leaving from Newark, Isru Chag Sukkot. Leaving that morning, Isru Chag Sukkot. So the guys, like, we all called each other, it's like, it was a 7 or 6 a.m. flight from Newark, Isru Chag Sukkot. So the guy said, I can't go. I'm not going. I have to take down the sukkah. I'm not. And Rabbi Grunblatt said, listen, there's Seder in Queens. You know, he called. And I have a cheap flight, $69. I'm not makbid if you come a little bit later, but the price is more expensive. You pay for the additional cost. And the guys did not want to do that. No, I'm private machine. We're not paying the extra toss. Right, Blumenbach was called. I didn't call him, but Blumenbach was called. He said, no, he doesn't feel that the yeshiva should have to pay for that. So the guys, we're going to be disrespectful, but I said, they're not going. So I was, I remember at my parents' home, and I was like in torture. What? We are going on strike against the Rosh Yeshiva or Grumlash. Like, I was appalled, like, to be part of it. Not that I disagreed, like, we have to pay $69 flight, $67. That was like a rough decision, but I couldn't. So I did something. I don't know if I did the right thing. I suspect I did not do the right thing, but I'm putting it on tape. I'm putting on recording. Whoever's listening to this, be Shaul Eitze. I should have been Shaul Eitze. I felt I could not be Mavaza or Rosh Yeshiva like that. Whatever it costs, I'll pay for myself. And I'll tell you what I did, and you tell me what I should have done. So I booked the ticket, and I went. I didn't go the 6 a.m. flight. It was like a day later. It was a strike going on. Nobody was going. So I booked the ticket myself, and I went. Came back to Miami. I landed at Miami International. There was no one went to Fort Lauderdale back then. And they told me to take a cab to Miami. The yeshiva was Miami Beach. So I don't remember. I took a cab to somewhere, to someone's house, right, Chait's house, who gave me a car, and then from there I drove to the yeshiva, which was on Miami Beach at the time. And I went to Rav Grumblatt, I spoke to him, I told him this what it cost. He says, I disagree, but to have to pay for it, but you know, you came back, and I don't want to close any machlokas, I'll split it with you. So he split the extra cost with me. Okay, very nice. What did I do wrong?
He wasn't sure.
Okay, aside from that, I did two things wrong. What did I do wrong?
Started Rosh Yeshiva.
Okay, started Rosh Yeshiva. Come on, you come up with something. Moshe, what do you say?
Yeah.
Huh?
Or maybe.
Maybe he felt guilty, so he paid for the other part, even though he said he wasn't going to.
Okay. He said he should have paid for it. Well, guilty. Of it?
Gone the other way.
What do you say? You know, not an opinion? You get a chance to shut me up.
Not tonight.
Okay. Not done? I don't know. Okay. Here's what I did wrong. The guys were livid with me. I basically made them look bad. Like, I was like this tzaddik who, you know, it was very nice you want to be a tzaddik, but I made them look bad. I didn't tell them I was going. I just ended up going. So I was like,
yeah, I thought you made
a paper.
Huh?
So what happened?
Like, nice. I came back and I told Agum about what thing, but I didn't tell my chaverim what I was doing. I think the, had I been Shaul Eitze, if somebody would have shown me Eitze, I think I would have figured that out. Like, you know, you're basically breaking the union. You're crossing the picket line. So if you cross the picket line, you have to be man enough to tell your chaverim that, you know, I'm crossing the picket line right now. They were very upset with me.
Rabbi Sharfman wasn't happy?
No, he was not happy. I remember him not being happy, and Rabbi Sachmina was not happy. And
if Rabbi did the right thing, why wouldn't they be? Because they got upset. They're going against yeshiva. They did the wrong thing.
I had many years.
Like,
even if you know, even if
that's my friend,
you should have done it. You should have still told them.
I should have told them. All I needed to do was tell them. Like, I'm very uncomfortable. I didn't have to explain myself even. I said, listen, it's not healthy for me to be at home right now. I need to get out of here. I can't start going to Queens. I have no coverages in Queens. They wouldn't just not come back to Miami. You know. But I don't know. I felt it wasn't the right way to deal with it.
Would they just be just as upset because Rabbi ended up going anyway? The whole point was that you went.
They all came back, but Rabbi eventually gave in, you know, and he paid for it. And I don't think Rabbi either anticipated what the reaction would be. Just like he did, Rabbi held it was Mamon Hegdish, so they had no money. Shiva had no money that year. There was no cook, there was no Mr. Stahl. So, not yet. He wasn't hired yet. So when they needed money, like for lunch. They had a caterer bring us lunch and supper every day.
Supper they had.
So it was, don't get so excited, a caterer. Oh, a caterer. They
no,
called.
I thought they had like the scouts rotating each different
night. No, the yeshiva wasn't that elaborate yet. They called a takeout food store who delivered us lunch and supper every day, and they had a great variety. It was bologna and coleslaw, or salami and coleslaw. Sunday was bologna, Monday was salami, Tuesday was bologna, Wednesday was salami, Thursday was bologna. I don't remember. Lunch was egg salad and tuna. Should I give you the variety again? Sunday was egg salad, Monday was tuna. And sometimes it was just like those plastic containers of egg salad. That to this day I can't eat it so easily because Sunday was egg salad. Imagine eating lunch. Here's an egg salad. Pass it. We'll take a little bit. Eat. Go home.
I think I would riot.
So, but every so often the takeout food, so somebody forgot to order, or they didn't deliver. So they would tell us to go next door. There was a pizza shop, a kosher pizza shop, next door to the yeshiva. So if that ever happened, we had to go there. That was, now it was a pizza shop, but that was worse than the tuna fish and egg salad. Okay? It was Schlemi's pizza. That stuff, I don't know how you could mess up pizza. But I think it's the only place ever that, and how did he pay for it? You know, from the takeout food store, they probably had a bill. You know, eventually they had to pay it up, or they eventually didn't pay it up. I don't know. But the pizza shop is not taking, they didn't order from them. We had each one in. So Raghumat would come in, walked into the base medrash, like 10 after 1, went underneath the Aron Kodesh, took out the pushka, and, you know, pulled off that tin on top, and looked, you know, and gave, okay, here's 225. Okay, and then he went to the next guy, 225, then, you know, counted all the change. He scrounged out like six 225s, and that's how they paid for lunch. And then the next day they couldn't do that because there was no money to do that. Okay, and that was an indignity, but not as big an indignity as having to eat that pizza. And, okay, so that was... You know, just to see, like we didn't agree with the, but okay, so that's okay. Rabbi Harris changed that rule. Now you come back, but you know, why did they change it? I don't know. They changed it because the guys couldn't handle it anymore, and we already couldn't handle it. We already couldn't. We were older guys and couldn't handle it. And Rabbi Grumblatt was worried about Mamon Hegdish, so he was also right. It's not like he held we should come back early morning. Just, is this Mamon Hegdash or is it not Mamon Hegdash? So since Yeshiva and Queen started Issur Chag, so he felt that Miami also started Issur Chag. Elamai, you don't want to come. So okay, I'm asking to have you come later. But then you pay for the difference in ticket. It wasn't worth the whole Sichsuch, but he didn't anticipate that was going to happen. He just thought that the guys will pay the $30 extra. He didn't think he should pay Mamon Hegdash. Now, I would not bat an eyelash if I thought that it was, I wouldn't even gone through the first step. You know, like that became a bigger thing. What the yeshivas now spend on the tovas hana, on the good feelings that the talmidim should have, we spend a lot of money on that now. It could be those days when the yeshiva was less affluent.
Yeah.
That's what the flights were $69 back then.
Is it because of the
kind of marshmallow? That story deserves a marshmallow.
Is it because of everything? Maybe back then it was because they didn't need it as much as you need it now. We need all this good.
There is truth to that.
Even if there was enough money, but who said they need all this?
That what? The
it seems that they were able to survive from their exile and tuna. Maybe they could have got a little better, but I assume compared to back then, we're a lot more spoiled when we had ice cream for cake break and brownies for cake break. And pizza 3 days in a row. And Rebbe had egg salad for lunch every day.
Yeah, well, I didn't do so good with that. I remember that was, I remember the yeshiva got a donation of 25 cases of Duncan Hines mint chocolate chips. And it was one of those runs that they tried. I think we ended up with all 25 cases that they ever produced. Ended up in the Torah Chaim kitchen. And some days that was lunch.
No.
Yes, we were able to eat
chocolate
chip
cookies.
And Duncan Hines
is
cookies.
It was Duncan Hines cookies, you know. And I cannot eat a mint chocolate chip cookie to this day. You know, we ate it every day. And the yeshiva didn't buy any snacks or anything because there were 25 cases. The yeshiva took it in because they thought they could sell them. Okay, but anyone knows the history of the queen's suits. Yeshivas can't sell things. It'll never work. Yeshiva can't sell anything. It just doesn't happen. So I heard a good word once, why? The Rebbe might explain this with the suits, that yeshivas work shelo al pi derech hateva. Okay, so how does yeshiva make money? It makes no sense, but the money comes in, the Baruch Shalom arranges the money come in. Once you try and make a business at the yeshiva, you know, you try to have down the yeshiva, which works out, you try to make teva out of it, but the yeshiva works shelo al pi derech hateva, so they couldn't sell a suit. Everyone else makes a mint of money on these suits, except the yeshiva.
The yeshiva seems to be doing pretty well, making money.
They do?
Like, what seems to be doing pretty well?
Huh? Who's selling suits?
No, selling real estate.
Oh, real estate.
Okay.
But it's not so pushy either, like buying real estate.
That's not all there.
You know, like I recently spoke to someone who invests money, and he said that if you're investing money, it's not so simple to invest money in, like, a house in Miami. I guess someone should invest. Should I, as an investment, should buy a house? They said no.
That's an Amazon.
You should not. You should not buy a house because he doesn't think you should buy Amazon either. Because, if you're buying in Manhattan, you're buying real estate in Manhattan, there's nothing that's happening to the real estate in Manhattan. But you don't know. In Florida, you know, maybe downtown Miami, maybe, yeah. But in North Miami Beach, you can buy a house today at $450,000, $500,000. You can't be sure that in 2 years from now it's not going to be worth $300,000. Who knows what the market's going to be? Let's say who drove up the prices? The from people, Chabad drove up the prices first, tremendous amount of money. Chaim Werdiger, my former neighbor across the street, put in a mikveh by Kal Chassidim so he could. He was a real estate agent, so he could sell homes to Chassidim. Guy's a genius real estate agent. He put in money. He himself put the mikveh in. He says, and he made Kal Chassidim. He bought the building from Shari and opened up a mikveh. Werdiger. Mordechai Ben David's brother. He used to live in Churn's house.
It wasn't Weider, did it?
No. It wasn't Weider. Weider made himself into the macher, you know, sidekick, but it was Chaim Werdiger who did it. And he started selling all these properties to Chassidim. Genius. He really, Chassidim had money, and he needed customers, so he put in a mikveh in, opened up a shtetl, and started selling them all the properties. They're the ones who started driving up the prices. But one wrong move, and there aren't enough here to keep them there. They leave. What's that? The Satmar Rebbe ever sells his house, and who's the other one? No, Biala. That's driving up the cost of real estate. The Biala really moves out. That'll cause a whole exodus from people. So who knows what will be real estate over here? It's not like stable. So he said you don't buy property for investment. He didn't think so. Anyway,
Rebbe, what was the biggest issue brought up at the time of our convention? The most pressing, urgent.
In the meeting.
I got the most pressing issue. One of the big issues I heard is that there was a question brought up that I mentioned today about splitting classes. A parent wants to put my kid in the frumer class. That was very, very important. Like there has to be one person who has seichel to make that decision. And it's usually the menal. Menal has to make that decision. Rabbi Gita has to make that decision. Because no one could know. He can't remember to tell everyone all the different cheshbonos that go into it. And he's the one who knows the strengths of each Rebbe and the weaknesses of each kid and who will work one with, well and the other with the other and all the different other cheshbonos. So it's not something he can even sometimes discuss with other people. Maybe he sits down with someone, but one person has to have all that information. So that was very important. He saw to him, but it wasn't earth-shattering. I thought it was, see the Novominska's reaction to that question. What was the question they said was a crazy question? Yeah, how do you teach kids to be tolerant of other kids' handicaps or lesser from Frumkeit? His response to that question was to me, such a chizuk to see. Like, he thought it was the craziest question he ever heard. He used to have, he looked up to the moderator. At the tournaments are quite, they used to ask good questions by this Shalas and Shub. It's such a question. He says, it's the Pharisees. He says, Rahalachta Bidrachav, Mahu Racham Avatarachav. What kind of question is that? You teach you have to emulate Hashem. The guy's acting like a mensch. He's not acting like a mensch. You're not tolerant to someone because he's not from me. How can you do that? How can you do such a thing? Then he didn't understand the question. But he got all. Novominska Rebbe was like very, very extreme. I'm
surprised he didn't get. No one got upset at the question about the kicking out the kid if the second brother didn't come.
Yeah.
I thought that was
also crazy. The question was, how do you. The parent promised, I'll send you one kid, I'll send you all my kids. And then after the first kid, the second kid didn't come, and they wanted to kick out the first kid.
Obviously, the first kid had problems.
No, the first kid did have problems.
Yes, very good.
It was one of these, you know, Lakewood yeshivas or Brooklyn yeshivas that in the old days, that's where Tver Israel was. Oh my gosh, I remember calling up from one of my relatives to get a kid, to get their kid in. And first they said no, and then my relative said, I need you to call again. And if you don't cringe when you call about what you have to say, then you're not doing what I'm asking. I need you to call and cringe. Like, I have to, like, really lay on the thing. So I laid it on. And they didn't take him. But they made him sure that he should go to another year of, because he's a little bit on the borderline, he's age-wise, go to another year preschool, and they'll commit for the following year. So that's what they did, but very, very hard. You couldn't get a kid in. So it could be, you're talking about a yeshiva here where they could take anyone they want. So why should they take your one kid? They only took him because you're sending all the kids. So they'll send it to a different.
So once he's in yeshiva, you want
like, it's not like they're looking at it like, I'm doing you a favor by latter kid every second. There's no concept of once your kids are right for Christ to actually hear them and then
right.
And walk into night.
There's also, like, we don't realize, Ashrenu Matov Chalkeinu, we don't realize how schooled we are in Musar. I think Rav Elia Brudny said that when he was 17 years old, he was first year Beis Medrash, it was the first time he opened up a Mesillas Yesharim. And he said, even though it was the first time he learned Mesillas Yesharim, but it wasn't foreign to him. He had heard the concept of Ma'achavos Abalamo. He heard the idea. He heard the concept of Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, and this world is a prosdor to the Troklin, to the big. He heard those concepts. So he says, regretfully, nowadays, now this is totally, I don't think is true, is this true in our high school? Do you think a kid graduating our high, a senior, who's not in Beis Medrash? Like, we have a lot of special seniors now, but maybe we could ask Moshe, maybe you could comment on this. Okay, but you had Rabbi Dreyfus, who Bedavka did Mesillas Yesharim. But I know he spent a lot of time on that. But do you think the average Talmud graduating our high school who did not go through any Bais Medrash, you know, schedule other than like maybe 12th grade Bais Medrash, would they know what Machavasa Balama meant and Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba? And I thought it would have Dover Pashit, but it seems from the convention, Ruba, do not do any kind of Musar learning.
I can't believe that someone coming out of Yeshiva wouldn't know a basic concept.
Did you?
Like Olam Hazeh.
Did you?
Yeah, I learned Vasilis Yashar myself in 11th grade.
Why?
I had a Seder because.
With
myself. I wanted to learn it. All
right. Even the things you do right are not normal. That's amazing. I never heard such a thing. But what most people, from your Yeshiva.
But I also, when I was like in first grade, I read through the whole Medrash, because I found it really fascinating. But like, I find it hard to believe that someone can come out of a yeshiva high school, and not know Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba. Like,
I can't imagine either. But but we have Musa Shmuzim every week, but they also have Musa Shmuzim. We have Rabbi Achnes giving Musar.
Like, you better do this. Like, Musar is like, it's discipline. It's not, it's like, and then like, nobody listens.
He's
nobody
right.
wants
to
absorb any sort of message.
It's right, but that's what he was espousing, Rabbi Brittany. He was saying that we have to teach Musar. We're not teaching any Musar. Even Rev. What was his name? No, the other one. What was it? No. The Musavad, the grandson. Yeah, Rav Obi's grandson.
He was fairly well versed.
You know, he was well versed, but wasn't he saying that he thinks Musa's coming back? Like, I never viewed it like Musa went away. So
I think he's coming back.
The yeshivas.
Anyone in the world agree with
that? Huh? Whatever, he's giving the Musa, but that means what he's seeing is that people, they're not learning Musar, really. Though.
Can it be like,
right?
Like,
isn't that
maybe compared to back then where they had Bais and Musars and everything? And
I would think the average Talmud in our yeshiva, I'm just thinking of the 12th grade. We were just with the 12th grade. The average kid there, is the Beinoni kid, you think they would know Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba, Prozdor? There's a song like that, isn't there? When I was in Kamenetz, we did not learn.
What was
Mr. Sharm or Sadiqim, we did Chovas al Talmidim. I remember in 10th grade, Chovas al Talmidim. Who wrote that? I don't remember.
Isn't like a chassid or something?
The Piachinska.
Something?
Yeah. In was it Warsaw?
I didn't do any Mr. Sharm. I remember being just fascinated. I remember being fascinated by Mr. Sharm or Sadiqim. First year Bais Medrash in Chofetz Chaim.
Was Sean that?
I was like fascinated. And I didn't know anything about Musar. I also confused Musar with. You did that? Like, Musar was like, as most people think, like you Musar a guy out. It was meant as criticism, not as Musar.
Is Pshat that yeshivas expected the parents to teach the children this?
You just remind me of another great word from Reuben Feinstein. As a good word, in Gittin on Beis Amin Aleph, the Safrala at Tosfos goes into Paschal Adama and Nida. So like when something like that comes up, you just the Rebbe should just say over what the basic biology is. You know, don't assume they know anything. You just say over. I remember when I was in 9th grade, so Rebbe, something came up with Gemara Bordan, something about Nida, and the Rebbe, I remember asking me in class, do you know what he is? I said, yeah. What is it? He asked me, what is it? So, now I didn't know what it was, but I thought I knew what it was because I vaguely remember in Tosfos said, quoted from Maseches Nida, and it said something about Mamzerim and something. So I assume that that's what the Masach, that's what Nida is. I said, yeah, we have Mamzerim. And he told me, I'll give a whole speech on Nida, but that's not the way to do it. And you don't ask the person what it is. You just say over the basics. It takes, you know, in three sentences, you can say over the basics. And the Mela, first of all, the kid learns it. Binyani Kedusha, Rabbi Brigida had such a great chap. Earlier in the year, he went in to discuss these inyanim with one of the lower, younger shirim, and he came up with a good word there was a lewd conversation in one of the classes, so he wanted to speak to them about why we shouldn't have lewd conversations, and the concept came up is Barasi Yetzahara, Barasi Torah Tavlin. It's a great insight by Rabbi Yehuda. Barasi Yetzahara, Barasi Torah Tavlin. So Hashem created Yetzahara, but he also created Torah as the anecdote to fight the Yetzahara. So he said, think about it. If a person wants to fight the Yetzahara, what does he do? He learns. Okay, what does he learn? So next year, let's say we're learning Ksuvos. Ksuvos has the most graphic, in detail discussions on, you know, in Yonei Isha. So if you want to fight the Yetzahara by talking about in Yonei Isha, you could learn Ksuvos, which fights the Yetzahara. There's a mystical koach haTorah that when something is done by kedusha, it has the opposite effect that we would think, because it really is a darshah of kedusha. But if you treat it by kedusha,
you never had the kid like start laughing while class.
Of course, what if he laughs?
He gets
giddy, he's nervous. You just say over like, I see you laughing, but you know, like. We're old men. We're mature men. This is how it goes.
If Rebbe saw someone learning and then like halacha, Rebbe wouldn't think that's strange. Rebbe think that's good.
I saw a seventh grader with a art scroll, Hilchos Nida book.
If Rebbe saw high school,
I would sit down next to him and say, "Okay, what do you want to know? I can teach it to you faster than you could read it. What do you want to know? I'll tell you everything. What do you need to know?"
So Rebbe wouldn't.
The kid's pretty desperate if he's trying to get his kicks, his thrills from the Eider need the book. You know, we could do better. We could do better for him than that. I'd spare him the torture and tell him myself.
So Rebbe thinks it is rather for. I mean, it's a good thing, not even a bad thing, if you see random high school kid learning about Inyani Ishas and...
Like what? What does he want to know? And Isha, there's a lot of curiosity and...
That's stemming from Yetzahara, though.
Nah, it's not always Yetzahara. You know, there are a lot of reasons the Rebbe Shalom made Yetzahara, but... You know, there's... If the Rebbe Shalom created Yetzahara, there's... We view it as like, it's a struggle... a very big struggle, it's a big deciding, but in the scheme of things, in the broad scheme of things, the Yetzer is good. Think about it. Let's talk about eating as a, you know, as a taiva. So you think about it, such an amazing, Hashem could have created a person, he doesn't have to eat. And be that kind of created person, he has to eat, for what? Could live without eating. Hashem could have created us without eating. But there are such, you know, enjoyment of people eating. They look forward to the meal, what's going to be for the breakfast, then they go to get to eat, then you can learn, then you go, you know, there's going to be a good lunch, and then there's going to be a good supper, like three times a day. So it adds a tremendous amount of drive and motivation for the day. There's all these good things to look forward to. So to a certain extent, you know, chayvus in the world, okay, you have to use it, you have to eat machalos that are mutaros and fulfill the chayvus in mutar different ways, but be'etzem, there's a Hashem created this, it's l'tov. So I'm not saying it's coming from a bad thing. Bad thing.
We should say it's a good thing, then, so people should learn it, because that's the helps with their taiva, because it's kedusha, and that's the whole goal of it. So I should dafka push people to learn
really,
this.
We don't ask our kid from learning. You know, if guys want to learn Masechta, wants to learn Hilchos Nida.
Masechta, Hilchos Nida, and Hilchos, all these halachos, and.
If he's old enough, what's going to happen?
So then, if Rebbe's saying it's a good thing, then we should let someone learn that and push for him, because if he's learning about it and doesn't do
shots. You're asking good, but I've been in this issue for 24 years. I never, maybe they do it in front of me, but I don't see too many kids doing that. They want to learn, if that's what they want to learn. You know, I don't see too much damage coming from that. It doesn't happen too often.
Anyone can come and ask me where
they want to show them. You show him, like, he'll learn it.
He thought that, sorry, he had wrong arm up, so I didn't.
Okay, but you think the kid ended up, like, as a, got him from learning, okay, it's not the normal thing. I wouldn't have. It was a third grader, maybe.
In a way, what would be the difference in that in an inappropriate book? Because
the inappropriate book was, that's how I'm telling you. Barasi Yetzirah, Barasi Torah Tavlin. He wants to create, he has a nisayon to read this inappropriate book. So what does he do? In order to get out of the nisayon, he learns Ksubas. Right? The Ksubas is discussing also in Yana Isha. Right? But that is the controls his taiva for that, because that was written betumah, right? And it was being promiscuous and immoral, and ksubis was not immoral. That was Torah. It's a chelik of Torah.
A mystical power of, or is Rebbe saying in my brain, I know this is.
No, I'm saying it's that's the koach haTorah.
Psychological.
You want to call it mystical? You call it mystical.
It's mystical.
I would say it's the koach haTorah.
That's mystical.
Okay, you like the mystical, it's Kabbalah, Kabbalistic. Smarty. I'm saying he has an inappropriate book he doesn't want to read, but he has a time to read it. So what does he have to do? Oh, he knows Barasi Yetzirah, Barasi Torah Tavlin. So I'm learning Ksubis to protect me from the Nisayan of reading that book. Yeah, because Ksubis is, you know, Kedusha. Yeah, he's not going to get any, he's not going to have any hefsid from doing Ksubis. Or learning the Hilchos Nida.
So
I doubt it. Okay, there's such a thing of learning it for the wrong reason. I'd say it's not possible, but I don't think I'm a sort of.
So why don't the Hasidic Yeshivas learn this? What's their Shita?
I don't know. I'm not a Hasidic Yeshiva. I don't know. They have a different culture.
After the issue about mixing the classes.
But what?
From class would be like a culture game from the Yeshiva and Rashad and whatever. Said about the academics, right?
You're asking what? That's being splitting it for academics?
No, it's not how you ever said it. Right? It was Rav Shach also was very against it.
Because the Rashiva held out Bali Gaiva, and Rav Shach said because the other class would feel like dummies.
So I assume it's probably a culture game for the from Canada.
Lechazne says it's even better to have kids who are not as from.
Takes care of both problems.
But depends, not from by what, you know. But he thinks it's better. But then nowadays it's a crazy world out there. But if it's because of internet, that many of the Lechazne feel that the internet's different. Internet's like it's a killer. They felt someone who has access to internet that they can become mamish. Like Goyim. Their whole lives will be like Goyish. So.
Then our whole high school, almost every single kid has access to internet. I don't know, it didn't seem like they turned out.
Our whole high school? Our whole world. Our whole world, Nebuch has you know, access to the... Listen, there's always schmutz in the world, but having access to it was not so easy. If you wanted to go, when I was in high school, if you wanted to go to a to watch pornography, you had to like take, you know, 3 buses and a train. You know, like, who's gonna do that? Like 3 buses and a train. Where are you going? Where are your parents? Like, you know, like there'd be like a 4-hour excursion, and you had to be back in there. So it was not so easy. But now, what does he have to do? Is to go, no one's home, he goes on his computer or his iPhone or whatever. Put that in his pocket at night, under the covers, whatever. Do anything he wants. So that's, it's quite a difference, you know? Not so easy at all. So that's really the basic, you know, the biggest difference, you know? So like, someone advised me that in the yeshiva we should split the classes based on from kite.
That's good. That would create a lot of division.
And
that makes things worse.
You know, they feel like if someone does not want their kid to be exposed, so you have no choice. You have to do it. That's what they're telling me. You have to do that. I don't think we need to do that. I think if we continue these honors track, the kids who are on the honest track, and we use some criteria, you don't have to, you know, not have a television.
Isn't a certain amount of exposure good for them? As in the vaccine theory?
Not unfiltered internet.
There's a difference between being acquaintances of people who have unfiltered internet and having unfiltered internet.
If you're exposing them to the... That itself is a bigger danger.
How does that get around Shiva's problem of our honors track? I mean, at least when I speak to some people, the kid tells me, oh, strict on me, I always want to be the honors. They don't even talk to me because they think they're so much better than me. I feel bad, I don't know what to answer him.
The kids say that now?
One kid came over to me and he always...
One kid's 9th grader? 10th grader? Don't tell me who.
Yeah, but I'm thinking also, I just think it's different, but I feel like the Rishiva was saying Magaiva. So how does that get around? He told me they're too cool, they don't speak to us.
Yeah,
that sounds like Magaiva.
We didn't do this to help the Gaiva. The Rishiva is right, but what would you do? Would you do it, or would you rather close the yeshiva? I think the Rishiva was saying call all the yeshiva and try to minimize the Gaiva. So like, one of the branches told me today...
I would just have 2 classes that aren't differentiated teaching. I thought that's the whole.
Because we know from the feedback we're getting that people, that's what people are looking for.
It's only because of parents.
Yeah, to a large extent, we thought we were being matzliach, but that's not what they want. So what are you gonna do? You know, like one reshiva told me in one of our branches, they hired a rebbe not from the yeshiva. And one of their, from surveying their parents, they were very, people were not sending there. And they said, you only hire from the yeshiva. Like, you know, we're ready to support yeshiva, but we don't only want to hire. We don't only want to send our kids to. So they hired one rabbi not from the yeshiva. So.
Miami?
You know, it wasn't Miami. No, so. I said you spoke it over at Grimblatt. He said, yeah, I thought we should do it. We should hire him. Hire the person. Why? He says, because you're not going to have a yeshiva. You don't get kids. You're going to have to close the yeshiva. So you're not going to hire any. You're not going to have anyone in the yeshiva teaching them either, because they're going to have to go to a different yeshiva. So, you know, so we have no choice. You have no choice. So, okay, listen, we prefer hiring people who you... are familiar with their derech, with their this, but not at the expense of closing the doors of the yeshiva. So like, we did the same thing. Not everyone understood, but you know, we hired someone not from the yeshiva, but first of all, we were extremely meticulous on who we would hire. Not every, we wouldn't just hire anyone, any token. But at the same time, it's not going to be helpful to any of the Talmidim to not have the yeshiva. Close the yeshiva. Okay, that's good.